Why do so many people starve? Dear Lily, in almost all civilizations, sooner or later, large numbers of people starve to death. I'm not talking about malnutrition or seasonal shortages, which are almost universal in agricultural societies. Famine is different in degree and kind, a particularly awful kind of catastrophe. Famine refers to a state where people actually die of hunger or hunger-aggravated diseases. They that die by famine die by inches. People's emaciated bodies suck up the reserves of fat, a horrific way to die. There have been great famines in India, China, Russia and Europe, and now the land of frequent famine is Africa. What causes famine? The case of Africa reminds us of some of the most frequently cited arguments to explain famine. These are variations in weather, usually too much or too little rain, war and political dislocation, pests, low prices for crops, corruption, and poor communications. There are also, as in many countries in the past, local tolls which prevent the movement of food except at very high costs. Yet, while all of these may be important, we have to look a little deeper to understand the almost universal tendency towards famine in agrarian civilizations. In the majority of societies, famine is related to overpopulation. The size of the population increases as a result of a temporary improvement in resources. For a while there is relative plenty, then demand begins to exceed supply and people are even more vulnerable to food shortages. Changing from several types of crop to just one can be disastrous. The wide variety of crops and livestock which provide a buffer for people in difficult years is replaced by just one. Everyone grows potatoes, or rice, or wheat, or cotton, or coffee, and little else. When that crop is threatened, there is nothing much to fall back on. Another cause of famine is the widespread tendency for the strong to prey on the weak, to extract from them as much of what they produce as possible, so that most people live with their noses just above the water of disaster. In bad years, they drown. This is a worldwide situation. The pressures of lenders to extract from borrowers are international. The rich countries of the world have lent large sums of money to the poor, and now much of the prosperity of these poorer countries is being sucked out of them in interest payments. The activities of the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank are often criticized for supporting this unfairness. they are accused of putting enormous pressure on developing world countries to drop their customary agricultural methods and to specialize in crops that then cannot compete against the subsidized crops produced in richer parts of the world. Often the family in its desperation preys on itself, its members driven to ever harder and harder and lower paid work, replacing animals and other labor-saving devices by their own labor. As these processes work through time, almost everywhere in the world, we see vast areas of poverty. If there is a small variation in politics or weather, disastrous famines then ensue. What should we do if famine threatens? An obvious thought is that the government should do something about it. Yet many argue that the amount of damage caused by government interference outweighs the positive effects. They suggest that the so-called laws of the market be allowed to operate. If there is a scarcity, the shortage will raise the price of that commodity. For example, if wheat is scarce, more will then be produced because it is worth producing. And in due course, the shortage will automatically be corrected. On the other hand, government efforts to force farmers to sell their produce cheaply can have a disastrous effect. The grain producers and merchants hoard their grain for later sales. They also tend to produce less of a commodity from which they gained little or no profit. So they argue, government interference causes famines rather than mitigating or preventing them. This theory was reasonable in the context of the commercialized agricultural systems that existed in 18th century England, Holland, and North America. Unfortunately, it does not work elsewhere or everywhere. When it was applied in Ireland in the 1840s or Bengal in India in the 1940s, it led to disaster. There are several flaws in the theory when it is applied beyond highly developed commercial economies. One lies in the nature of how food is produced. It may be often the case that over a few years market prices will encourage more production of a particular crop. Yet, for those who are starving to death, it is not possible to wait for a few years until more grain is planted and harvested. The theory also assumes the kind of geography, ecology, and good water communications found in Western Europe. When there was a threat of famine here in the past, one region could supply another, since the areas with acute shortage were quite local. This does not apply to the huge stretches of monoculture found in landlocked areas of India, China, or Central Europe. Wheat or rice or maize is almost all that is grown for hundreds or thousands of miles. There is no way it can be replaced from a nearby area if the harvest fails. So people will starve to death. In Bengal in the 1940s and Ethiopia in the 1980s, there were foodstuffs available. either in stores or at the end of railway lines. Yet there was no market mechanism available to draw them towards the starving. In such situations, ordinary people lack the economic power, in other words, money, to pay for the food. They may clamour outside the warehouse, but no one is going to give a valuable grain away for free. So they starve. The laws of supply and demand do not work because although there is a huge demand, in one sense, starving families dying in agony, there is no effective demand because the starving families have nothing to bargain with. Work for food programs, the artificial creation of some bargaining power for very poor people, is one solution in a situation where most people have never really entered fully into a market system. Only by making them commercial consumers, giving them coupons, so to speak, to start them off, can they be given the chance to rise above an impoverishment where they have nothing that the food producers want, not even their bodily labour. These two major arguments as to what should be done to prevent or alleviate famines refer to different cases. One analysis works reasonably in the historical English context, where the population was well above subsistence level, where the market forces operated reasonably, where shortages were relatively local, and ways of carrying bulk goods like grain were well developed. The other analysis applies to situations where there is food available, but the poor starve because they do not have the money to pay for it. Neither of these theories, however, is applicable to most famines in history. Where there is an absolute shortage of food over a large area, there is no food, even if there were money to buy it. The available technology and crop patterns do not produce enough to feed the population in a difficult year. Here, the only escape is through much longer-term planning and the creation of a proper system of diverse agriculture, proper communications, and decent storage, and of a society where people live well above subsistence levels. Yet how can this possibly be achieved? When did the first escape from famine occur? On the eve of the Industrial Revolution, just 200 years ago, most people in Europe, Asia and Africa lived close to famine. Yet in England, a different situation had emerged. While even close neighbours, Scotland, Ireland, France, were still famine prone, England had somehow emerged and escaped from the normal tendency. How had this happened? The extraordinary fact, which everyone began to notice from about the 15th century, was how affluent the rural dwellers of England were. Highland Scots and French, Italians and Spanish, were often poorly dressed, fed and housed, and very often overworked. and ill. Yet many of their English counterparts wore reasonable clothes and good leather shoes, ate a good deal more protein, drank beer and ale, lived in reasonable houses, and worked moderate hours. Ordinary housing can be taken as just one example. England is the only country in the world where the houses of ordinary villagers of the 14th to 17th centuries have survived in large numbers. As I wrote this in a village farmer's house, which has changed little over a period of 300 years, I can see that the old houses still provide a comfortable and spacious environment for affluent countrymen, even in a relatively poor area of the Cambridge Fens. The relative affluence of the English can be seen from their eating habits. They have been able to let their wildlife teem around them. They cherish songbirds, leave much of the flora and fauna on their beaches untouched, do not like the idea of eating their horses or things like snails and frogs. I still remember my amazement when I went to a beach in France and found many people combing it for tiny creatures and seaweed of a kind that were left untouched on the beaches of my childhood in England. I also remember my feeling of sadness as I walked through the silent woods of France and Italy, where no birds sang or animals moved. Of course, there were exceptions to this picture. There were some who starved on the streets of England. Yet by the 18th century, while almost all the country people of Europe and Asia had reached a level only just above subsistence, many of the English were modestly affluent. Famine was a thing of the past, as it has only recently become in much of China and India. So are famines inevitable? How the divergence between a few fortunate societies and others occurred cannot be explained from within the framework of a discussion of famine. The immediate cause of famine is food shortage, but food shortage is just a symptom of other changes. The conditions that lead to the shortage are cumulative, just as the escape from famine is the result of cumulative changes. We can see this in the second half of the 20th century. Africa did not, on the whole, suffer from famines in the 1960s, while India and Bangladesh did. Now, despite terrible droughts or flooding, India and Bangladesh seem largely to have escaped from famine, while parts of Africa have almost perennial famine. Perhaps the climate has changed, but ultimately the reasons for these shifts are only partially related to that. Famines are ultimately man-made, even if they may be precipitated by nature. Nor are famines directly and inevitably the result of absolute numbers of people. When China or India had half or a quarter of their present population, they had serious famines. There are now many more people and yet no famine. It was sparsely inhabited Highland Scotland, not relatively densely crowded England that had famines in the 18th century. Ultimately, the presence or absence of famine is about human relations. Great inequalities breed famine. If, as in England, property is secure, people will benefit from their own work and from their own creative improvements. A large middling group will expand and absorb more and more people. Then a world where famine is only a distant memory can begin to emerge. In the case of Africa today, such a virtuous circle could be created, and perhaps is just beginning to appear. But it can be only after a careful analysis of all the potential traps these countries face: disease, poor soil, inadequate communications, political instability, the conditions attached to aid programs, the policies of the international agencies. The difficulty is that all the traps have to be avoided simultaneously. It's not enough just to improve agriculture or education or to provide political stability or to minimize malaria and AIDS. The whole package or system has to be altered. Open politics, security of property, these and many other assurances are needed. This is not easy when much of the wealth and attention of the world is devoted to attacking hidden threats of supposed terrorism or absorbed in making weapons for the lucrative arms trade.